Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Skyline Studio, and you are listening to the Nick DiGilio Show. Tom Hush is my producer. We're here till 4. Roger Badish is in the newsroom, and that's who's going to be keeping you company until 4 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on. Lots of other fun topics that we're going to get to. But that music obviously means that it is time for the movie reviews. We do it every week. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me. We talk about all the new movies and touch on the box office as well. So let's get the guys in here. Here's Eric. Welcome back. Are you there, Eric? Eric? Hold on. Eric? I don't hear Eric. Eric?
Hello?
Yeah. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. And Steve, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
All right. Good. Everybody's here. We got that all cleared up. Okay. So we've got some movies to talk about. Did you guys watch the SAG Awards? Eric, did you watch?
I did not watch the SAG. Mm.
I watched a little bit of them. I mean, there were no surprises in the movie categories, really.
No.
That's why I didn't watch.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're pretty much going to have to come to terms with the fact that Joaquin Phoenix is going to win an Oscar for it.
Movie.
Yeah. It looks like Renee Zellweger is going to get it. I mean, I think everything is set in stone. I thought the funniest speech of the night was Brad Pitt. I thought Brad Pitt was
about that.
He was very good.
He was hilarious. And there's like really some really kind of lovely footage of him backstage standing in front of a big screen TV watching Jennifer Aniston accept her award.
There was a nice moment where he talked about playing a guy who didn't get along with his wife, and they did a nice cut to her in the audience, kind of laughing at it. And I thought that's good direction. That's good television direction.
Yeah.
So not
a lot of surprises. And I think we all know what direction we're going to with the Academy Awards.
I don't know what's going to win Best Picture though. I'm totally confused.
Okay,
and director for that matter.
I think it's going to split again. I really do think it's going to split again.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. It's Nick DiGilio here, and we are with Eric and Steve, who join us every week to talk about the movies. That's what we're doing right now. Tom Hush is producing, and it's the Nick DiGilio Show right here on 720 WGN. Okay, Steve, why don't you tell us about the Les Miserables?
Yes. So this is the, speaking of Academy Awards, this just got nominated for Best International Feature, which was used to be Best Foreign Language Feature, but it was also the winner of the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival last year. It obviously shares the name of the classic novel by Victor Hugo, but it is not that story or the musical that was based on it. Although it does have a lot of the same themes as that book, themes about haves and have-nots and challenging corrupt authority and oppression of poverty. But it's mainly named that because the Paris neighborhood where it takes place, and I believe it's called Montfermeil, is where Victor Hugo wrote the novel and took inspiration from a lot of the surroundings that he saw, even back then. This is a debut feature from a French filmmaker named Lodge Lee, and it's basically driven by sort of the tense race relations and culture clashes and general sense of frustration with underemployment that is happening in this part of Paris. It's a real fascinating dissection of power, focusing a great deal on these children of Muslim immigrants from various backgrounds who spend a lot of summer days playing soccer and just sort of doing unremarkable sort of mischievous things. And then there are these Paris police officers. There's one named Stefan who has recently been transferred into this anti-crime squad in the community, and he's paired with these two other guys who are veterans, and they have pretty unorthodox methods, and they're a little rough around the edges, but they, everybody, all the different neighborhood groups know them. So the trio kind of find themselves overrun during the course of an arrest, and a drone owned by one of the local teens films something that they definitely do not want filmed, and a lot of the film is then the cops chasing down this drone footage, and they have to kind of work their way through the community and make the best use they can of their sort of allegiances and the connections they have in the neighborhood to make this happen. And apparently this is partially inspired by some riots that took place in the suburbs of Paris around 2005, and that lasted for weeks. And so there is a great deal of, like, volatile situations cropping up very quickly and just getting diffused almost as quickly. There are these magnificent characters to get in addition to the police, there are these different guys in the community, these leaders or the sort of crime leaders, but when the police actually try to arrest this one kid, like I said, this drone footage sort of captures what happens, and it's really bad news. And like I will say, the director does an exceptional job of immersing us in the neighborhood, from the bustling local markets to these claustrophobic stairwells and broken down parks. There's a final sort of sequence and shot that leaves a significant amount of the narrative thread completely up for interpretation, and that may seem like a bit of a cop-out, but really this is a film that never attempts to hand us easy answers about how to fix these things, because there really are none, and that's a powerful and, I think, pretty defiant statement. It's a film that challenges audiences to consider situations from every possible point of view, and though some may not like the ending, the trajectory of everyone involved in the various conflicts was intriguing enough to keep me along for the ride, certainly. So I'd say it's mostly positive for me. I know it's playing at the Music Box, and I think also River East.
Yeah, it is. All right. Well, there's that. And it's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're talking movie reviews with Eric and Steve. Tom Hush is the producer, and we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Okay, Eric, tell us about Jezebel.
Okay, this is a movie that is playing at the Facets this week. Played a few film festivals last year, including South by Southwest and our own Black Harvest Film Festival. And it's a story, it's kind of a semi-autobiographical story that's set in the sort of the early 1990s. The director of the film is a woman named Numa Perrier, and she plays a woman who works as a phone sex operator, and she lives in kind of a tight, cramped Las Vegas motel with a number of her family members, including her younger sister and their very ill mother. When the mother eventually passes away, very early in the film, the younger sister, Tiffany, is played by Tiffany Tennille, doesn't know exactly what what direction her life is going to go in, and her sister recommends that there's this new thing that is basically cam girls, and she actually recommends going to this local business and trying out as a cam girl. This is very much in the sort of the infancy of this, the internet was growing in the early 1990s. So she goes to this, seedy, but, not too seedy location, and becomes a cam girl and starts learning the ropes, with other women there. And, they also kind of form, a bit of community, to each other. And as she goes along, she becomes more comfortable in her skin and begins developing sort of greater relationships with the men that are frequenting this particular business. And so she's sort of a greater sense of empowerment, and not to mention the money that she's bringing in. There have been a number of movies about this particular profession before. A lot of them, tend to sort of err on the seedier side, and this movie certainly doesn't shy away from that. But this one is definitely less seedier than some of the other ones, mainly because the characters have really strong relationships, particularly between the two sisters. It's one of the things that helps, I think, set this movie apart from a lot of these other ones. There's also the fact that your protagonist is African American, there is elements of racism that get brought into this world, and so the way the film deals with that, I think, is something that we haven't quite seen, you know, portrayed in some of these other types of movies. The film kind of ends on kind of a abrupt note that kind of leaves a lot of threads kind of hanging about. But I think that this is it's you know, this weird world that you know these women occupy is always pretty fascinating. And I think this one is a bit better than a lot of the ones that we've seen, or at least I've seen at some of these film festivals. And again, it's particularly because I think the relationships and the lead actresses are quite strong in it. So it's definitely one to take a look at Facets.
Okay, that's called Jezebel, and it's playing at Facets. It's Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Skyline Studio, Nick DiGilio Show. Tom Hush is producing. Eric and Steve are here. They join me every week to talk about the movies, and Jezebel was the movie we were just talking about at Facets. By the way, I was just looking up, you know, the IMDb page for this, and by the way, they completely restructured IMDb.
I noticed that.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely, yeah, I mean, I was like, what? I didn't even know I was on the same website, but they completely changed it, so you got to navigate it a little closely. But anyway, I was looking at this, and the lead actress is from Chicago. Tiffany Tennille?
Yeah,
she's from Chicago.
Okay.
So, there you go. Okay. All right. We are going to continue with Eric and Steve and the movie reviews. 312-981-7200 is our number for any for talk and text, and the movie reviews continue. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's the Nick DiGilio Show. Tom Hush is producing. We're here until 4. Roger Badish has your news, and that's who's keeping you company into the late night, early morning. My father is going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, and every Monday my dad calls in and tells a joke, so we'll continue with that. We are going to be talking about real demands made by celebrities behind the scenes. Hank Azaria is no longer going to voice Apu on The Simpsons, and then we're going to talk more about most controversial TV characters. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text, and as we continue, it's Nick DiGilio, and Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning, / Sunday night, Monday morning, to review the new movies, and that's what we're doing, and we continue. Okay, Eric.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us, I'm sorry, Steve, tell us about Doolittle.
Damn it. Okay. So the new year is young, but thank goodness we didn't have to wait more than a couple weeks to hit our first sort of big budget military grade stink bomb of 2020.
I have to say, before you jump into this, I cannot believe who wrote and directed this movie.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's my next sentence.
I can't
literally.
Even, yeah, okay.
So the director and co-writer is a man named Steve Gagan, who won an Oscar a few years ago for writing Traffic. He also directed a couple films before this, Syriana and Gold. So, of course, he seems uniquely qualified to rework the character of Dr. John Doolittle, who was the central figure of a series of children's books by Hugh Lofting going back to the 1920s, and his adventures in communicating with animals and a few humans, too, have been adapted to the big screen a few times already, most famously Rex Harrison in the 67 musical Dr. Doolittle, and then a pair of Dr. Doolittle films starring Eddie Murphy. But this latest incarnation stars Robert Downey Jr. is the famed 19th century physician whose wife passes away, has passed away 7 years earlier than when we meet him, and ever since then he's confined himself to a life of solitude behind the walls of his country estate, where he lives and communicates with a variety of common and exotic animals, very often in their languages, although thankfully we hear most everything in English eventually. A young Queen Victoria, who's played by Jessie Buckley, falls gravely ill, and her, I guess, young ward, Lady Rose, is dispatched to pull Doolittle out of hiding and then to cure Her Majesty. So Rose arrives at his house about the same time as a local boy does named Tommy, and he's seeking the doctor's help as well because he shot a squirrel who's voiced by Craig Robinson, who he accidentally shot while being forced to go hunting by his family. Anyway, So while he isn't moaning and screeching with the animals, the first thing you sort of notice about Robert Downey Jr.'s performance is this weird choice of accent, which sounds vaguely Scottish. And I think the person that Dr. Doolittle was sort of based on was Scottish, but I'd never heard anyone try this accent before. He when we first meet him, he's kind of like long-bearded wild man, hiding from all outside visitors, but eventually he does sort of shave himself and saves the squirrel's life and agrees to help out the queen as well. And he takes this young kid, Tommy, as his sort of provisional apprentice. The sights and sounds of Dr. Doolittle conversing with animals, ranging from sort of a dog wearing glasses, who's voiced by Tom Holland, to a gorilla with PTSD, who's voiced by Rami Malek. There's a polar bear that John Cena voices, arguing with an ostrich, Kumail Nanjiani does. I guess they're all supposed to bring us this sense of wonder and amazement. Instead, the film is just a colossal bummer. Doolittle, he is in a deep depression for most of the film because his wife has died, but he's also so in love with how weird the movie's also sort of in love with how weird it thinks it's being and how edgy it is, and it kind of takes the wind out of every possible aspect of this movie that might be fantastical. The two younger actors spend most of the time on screen just sort of staring at things with wonder and big eyes, but basically the big eyes only really show us how empty their souls are, because they're just so, when people talk about stereotypical child actors, they're talking about these two, and maybe they could be better with different material, who knows. Anyway, Doolittle, along with his animals, sort of set out on this adventure to acquire some medicinal ingredients from a rare tree that's needed to save the queen. There's something of a conspiracy going on that involves some of the queen's close advisors, including one played by Jim Broadbent, as well as her personal physician, who's played by Michael Sheen. They get to this island where the tree is supposed to be. There's like a pirate king played by Antonio Banderas, reminding us why he's never been Oscar nominated before this week. And there's a tiger in it that's voiced by Ralph Fiennes, and a dragon, and I don't know. There's no shortage of voice and acting talent in the movie. And when you add to that, the cinematographer is Guillermo Navarro, who is Guillermo del Toro's regular cinematographer, but he's also lensed two of the three Night at the Museum films, which actually, when you watch this, makes a lot of sense. And there's a Danny Elfman score. I mean, like, there's a makings of a damn fine film here, so you'd think. But instead, we get like this cluttered, noisy, dark thing with not much of an adventure to speak of. I was watching Robert Downey intently at times, just looking for any clue what John Doolittle might be thinking, other than just this generic sadness. Honest to God, the Craig Robinson squirrel emotes more than Robert Downey Jr. does in this movie. And there's a couple funny line deliveries by some of the voice actors, and that's largely what makes the film even in any way watchable. The animal effects are really unimpressive. The action sequences are sparse and in desperate need of some inspiration. And by the end, I was bored, I was miffed, I was exhausted by watching so many good people work so hard to achieve mediocrity. So that's Dr. Doolittle, guys.
Okay. All right.
That's Doolittle.
Yeah. Nick DiGilio here, and it's Steve and Eric and Tom Hush is producing. We're here until 4, and we're doing the Sunday night / Monday morning reviews as we do every week. And again, it's the Nick DiGilio show. All right, Eric, where do you stand on Doolittle?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes movies come along and this movie's been kind of sitting on a shelf for a while and no one knew when it was going to come out, and there have been reshoots and problems with the production. I think, you know, that's sometimes kind of supersedes whatever quality or failure that the movie's ultimately going to kind of rest on. And, I'm not saying that that's not important, because I think that, it is right sometimes to be angry that $175 million was spent on a production like this and this is the end result. But at the same time, there's almost like a weird level of extra outrage, I think, sometimes for a movie that is just boring. After 90 minutes, which is really all this movie really is, I wasn't exactly exhausted. I was just kind of sat there slumped in my seat, trying to think that it would this movie really appeal to children. Yes, it's got all these talking animals and some great voice talent behind them, not that they would know who any of them are, but I kept thinking the entire movie, going back to the Eddie Murphy Doolittle movies, which is kind of, this movie kind of wants to like split the difference between being the kind of fantastical adventure type of story that going back to the Rex Harrison film, but then inserting the humor and the modern humor of the Eddie Murphy movies into this, and it doesn't make for a fine mix, because for one, the animals in this movie are not nearly as entertaining as they were in the Eddie Murphy movies, and the adventure is so CGI'd to the point of, I guess that's where any kind of exhaustion lies on my part, is that nothing feels genuine. Nothing feels, you don't really get a sense of place and the getting swept up along in this adventure, because you just see everything is just kind of fake, polished and fake and just not that interesting. Not even, weird performance from Robert Downey Jr. can save this. Craig Robinson's squirrel, his first line in the movie, made me laugh quite a bit. But beyond that, I just kind of was sitting there waiting to see if, this movie really going to be the disaster that people were setting me up for the kill for. And I think that the humor is not all that different from some of the mediocre children's fare, both animated and live action, that we've seen. And that's really all I got out of it. So, yeah, it's not very good, but I'm not going to waste a whole lot of outrage on it either.
Okay. And you said that this was sitting on the shelf for a while?
It's been sitting around. It's shifted release dates a few times. There have been reshoots on it. A new director was brought in to film some stuff, because Gagin was apparently a nightmare on set. And he was not a particularly good director before, I might point out. I'm not even a fan of Siriana. You release a $175 million production in the middle of January. That's not a good sign.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, that's Doolittle. It's Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show on a Monday morning, Sunday night, Monday morning. And we've got Eric Childress and Steve Procopi here to review the new movies, which we do every week, and that's what we're doing right now. So Doolittle is not worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Wait, Nick, you didn't see it?
No, I did not.
No, okay.
I did not. No, uh-uh. Yeah, I saw...
It's cold out there, Steve. It's cold.
Yeah, it was cold out.
Not that
weekend.
Cold.
Yeah. I saw the Eddie Murphy Doolittles, and that was fine. That was pretty much enough for me. So, I did see the other big movie that came out this week, and we're going to review that coming up. And 312, and the movie is Bad Boys for Life. It's the latest in the Bad Boys, well, now trilogy.
Yes.
With Martin Lawrence and Will Smith. So that's coming up. continue with the Nick DiGilio show here on 720 WGN. Tom Hush is producing. I'm Nick DiGilio. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me at this time every week to review the new movies on the Nick DiGilio show here on 720 WGN. And all right, Eric.
Yes.
Tell us about Bad Boys for Life.
Okay. Well, as you said before the break, this is the third part in what is now a trilogy of the series that began 25 years ago, we can age all of us. 25 years ago, we met Marcus Burnett and Mike Lowry, Martin Lawrence, Will Smith. And so now it is 2020, and as the movie opens, we are welcoming the birth of Marcus's grandchild. His daughter has given birth and is also on the verge of getting married. And he's thinking about retirement, Murtaugh style. And so Will Smith's Mike Lowry's character is not exactly ready to go off into the sunset, but when he becomes the target of a widow of a drug cartel kingpin who was taken out many years ago, Mike is on a list for assassination, and it seems like the bad boys are going to ride together one more time to stop the level of these assassinations from happening, including Mike's. So we get another series of chase sequences and shootouts and trying to get to the bottom of who is behind this scheme and whatnot. Joe Pantoliano is back as their captain. They actually kind of have a whole new crew around them as Marcus wants to be a bit more careful and have a bit more backup, a la Billy Crystal and Running Scared. This is exactly what you might expect from the Bad Boys series. But going back to the last time we met, or we hung out with these two, which was 17 years ago, we were given Bad Boys 2, which I don't know if we're complete unanimous here, but I still consider Bad Boys 2 to be one of the most revolting, vile experiences I've ever had in a movie theater.
I agree with you 100%.
Steve, are you with us on that?
I like Michael Shannon in it.
I completely forgot Michael Shannon. I blocked that movie out like nobody's business. That movie literally made me physically ill in the theater when I saw it. And I don't get motion sickness, but for other reasons, that movie made me ill. So needless to say, I was not looking forward to this movie. But this movie is not directed by Michael Bay. It's directed by a pair of new directors. Directors who have been doing features, but I'm actually not familiar with any of them. The names are Adil El Arbe and Bilal Fallah. And I thought I had seen one of the movies. I looked it up, and it turns out it was not the title of the movie that I thought I had seen. But they replaced Michael Bay. While a lot of the shootouts and the things that you might come to expect in the series do play out in a way, these directors have a few steps ahead of Michael Bay as far as terms of crafting the action sequences. I'm not saying that we're on the level of Mad Max Fury Road or anything like that here, but there's at least a coherence to some of them. There's occasionally a bit of creativity, there's a little bit of space, and I found myself at least semi-engaged watching the action sequences in this movie. I still don't really like these two characters. I never really have. They were certainly burdened in the first two movies by the comedy stylings of Michael Bay, and that certainly didn't help matters very much. And they're kind of at the same level of humor in this one, and every once in a while I got a chuckle out of me, but not so much. Plus, they were participants in Bad Boys 2, so I haven't quite forgiven them for that either. But like I said, this movie was surprisingly watchable. I didn't want the level of complaints that I would have had with Bad Boys 2 are not really did not really manifest themselves while I was watching this movie. So this all sounds like really faint praise here, but compared to the other two movies, and I'm not really recommending this entirely, but of the three movies, I would actually say that this is the best one of the three, just because I didn't feel like Michael Bay's style was sort of overwhelming the proceedings and trying to show us just how cool everything was. Maybe the fact that these characters, that we've all sort of aged with these characters, and they're sort of playing upon the fact that they're growing older and stuff like that, maybe that worked a little bit better for me. But at the same time, watching them sort of even steal, as I was alluding to, from Lethal Weapon and Running Scared and elements of those movies to use for their, you know, sort of new renaissance of these characters didn't really, you know, sit great with me either. So I'm not recommending the film, but I'm saying it's better than the two Michael Bay movies.
Okay. It is Nick DiGilio here on the Nick DiGilio Show, reviewing the new movies. Tom Hush is your producer. I'm Nick DiGilio. Eric and Steve are here. Steve, what about you?
I think I have the exact same review as Eric, but I am recommending it just barely. And we should mention that, for better or worse, Michael Bay doesn't come back as a director, but that doesn't mean he's not involved in this movie somehow. Tell me, okay, I don't think this is spoiling anything, but there was a moment, a fleeting moment near the beginning of the film where I thought this movie was going to be so gutsy. Because I thought they killed off a major character. I thought they were thinking about killing off a major character at the beginning of this movie. And I'm like, oh my God, that would make this movie so gutsy and so bold. And I'm like, I hadn't even considered they might do that, because if this is really supposed to be the last one of these, although they certainly set it up like it's not, but just a brief moment, I was like, oh, but of course, no, they don't kill it. They kill people, but they don't kill that person. So anyway, Eric's 100% right, though. When this film focuses on the action, oh my God, it's really great. And I will say, these two guys who mostly, I think, have made most of their films have been made in the Middle East, that they have a real flair for it. And there's like the chasing and the shooting and the general mayhem are at least a little bit more original than they're not the same as Michael Bay has given us in the past. I will say that the part of this that really let me down was, because this is like an action comedy series, and it's the comedy that's a real drag on this movie, and it kind of keeps it from being like a really righteous action romp. And I did like the inclusion of these newer characters, these younger, sort of more with it characters in this team that they work with, and Vanessa Hudgens is one of them. But I kind of like that interaction and just that comparison of the older generation versus the younger generation, how they kind of make it work. There's a couple strange little story twists in this that, one which I think is sort of genuinely shocking, the other is kind of genuinely laughable. I was also really impressed with the villainess, who is, I guess, supposed to be a witch, played by Kate Del Castillo, who it took me a while to realize where I knew her from. I had seen her in this film last year called El Chicano, but do you guys know what she's famous, like really famous?
Steve, we're running out of time.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, she was friends with El Chapo. Anyway, so my point is that, like I said, the Bad Boys for Life isn't an embarrassment, I guess. Yeah. That's not saying much, but, you know, for those who hold it dear, this franchise dear, I'm sure they'll like it.
Okay. All right. I'm with you guys entirely. I think it's actually a pretty well-made movie, and it's definitely better than the other two.
Yeah.
So, all right, guys. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yep.
All right. Eric and Steve, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on 720 WGN. It's Nick DiGilio here.